This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with writer Nancy Mares. Her new memoir, Waist High in the World, chronicles living with multiple sclerosis. This progressive illness was diagnosed over 20 years ago. Now, Mares can no longer walk, and she can use only one arm, and that arm has little strength.
Now, have you changed your attitude toward being cared for? As you said, your husband cares for you. He dresses you. He takes care of a lot of your... he bathes you, I imagine.
Yes, he helps me get into and out of the shower and puts the lotion on afterwards and all that.
It can be really hard to be cared for on a regular basis.
I hate it. I'm working on it. I certainly... if I weren't going to just drive myself over the brink, I had to accept it. And so I work very hard at accepting it. And most of the time I do pretty well. But then something will happen like, I guess it was about a month ago, I fell off the toilet. And it was an enormously humiliating experience. I was locked in my studio, which is separate from the house. Fortunately, it was the housekeeper's day. But she was in the house listening to Spanish music at top volume, I knew, because I'd just been in there. So I'm lying on the bathroom floor of my studio saying, help, help. Finally, I got tired of that, so I started saying, I've fallen and I can't get up. And eventually, Carmen came out to sweep the porch and the walk, and she heard me, and she knew where the spare key was, and she opened the door, let herself into the studio, and cleaned me up and pulled my clothes back on, and I went on with my life, because humiliation turns out not to be terminal disease. But it's damned unpleasant, and I just hated that. I hated every minute of it. It was humiliating and also frightening.
Would you have preferred that your husband rescued you from that episode, or was it better to have someone who you have a professional relationship with?
No, I really would have preferred George. George and I are extremely intimate. Partners tend to be, but I mean even beyond that, because the nature of his cancer entailed bowel surgery and a lot of kind of messy things, chemotherapy with lots of throwing up and what have you. So I feel very close to his body, and I think he feels very close to my body. And it was very, very difficult for me to permit an outsider to see me in that condition. Carmen is hardly an outsider. She's been my housekeeper for 9 years now. But even so, we haven't had, a relationship that involved picking me up off the bathroom floor before. And I just was devastated by that. And one has to accept those feelings of humiliation and devastation. One has to feel them and accept them, as unpleasant as they are, in order to be able to let them go and go on with one's life.
Let me ask something gloomy. A little earlier, you said that when you thought your husband might be having a recurrence of his cancer, you seriously considered taking your life, and you didn't, and it turned out that it was a false alarm. But excuse me for bringing this up, but say he did pass before you. How would you, do you think about that kind of thing now, how you would cope?
I think about that thing all the time. With a good bit of fear and a great deal of sadness. My guess is that even though I told you that I believe that suicide is the wrong choice, that I might well make that choice. What would discourage me, I think, is concern for my children, who are now not little children at all. They're 27 and 31. And I have just learned that I'm going to have a grandbaby next summer.
Oh, congratulations.
And isn't that wonderful? They've been trying for a long time, and it's really going to happen, we think. So anyway, if I were to kill myself, then I would leave these children with a mother who committed suicide. And I'm not sure that I could do that to them, you know? Mm-hmm. I almost did a couple of times, and I'm appalled now, in retrospect, at what those suicide attempts conveyed to my children, that they had a mother who was willing to leave them. And I don't want them to have to live with that, to believe themselves that cheaply valued, that I would be willing to leave them. And people, you know, have asked me, well, you know, couldn't I live with the children or have them take care of me? And I've said stiffly, that's not who I want to be in their lives.
Right.
And it isn't at all. But the fact is that I can't know what's going to happen if George does die before me. Who knows what will happen?
Mm-hmm.
I pray, of course, that I'm going to die before him. I go to bed at night ready, not suicidal at all, but simply I've had a good day, and basically I say, okay, God, I don't believe God does these things, but, you know, it's sort of a convenient way of framing things. It's an habitual way of framing. Okay, God, tonight could be the night. I'm ready.
Do you feel that medically you're close to death, or are you just saying
that
more metaphorically?
I'm not, I think. I think I'm, aside from the fact that I'm a smoker, I'm probably in quite good health.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, people with disabilities aren't sick necessarily. We get sick. My husband's got a cold, and I suppose I'm going to get it too, just like anybody.
Yeah.
But as a rule, I'm pretty healthy. So, no, there isn't any immediate reason that I ought to die. But I wouldn't mind if it were offered to me. You know, I try to live my life each day in such a way that it can be the last day, and I will be satisfied with it.
So you're a smoker, huh? Do you think...
Alas, I am.
Do you feel that having MS almost gives you an excuse to smoke because, A, there's a lot of pleasures you're deprived of, and B, it's not like you're going to run the mile anyways?
Well, both of those things, particularly the former, I think. I have this feeling that I have had to give up so damn much. I just don't feel like giving up one more thing. And anyway, guess what am I staying alive for? So, but it's a perfectly self-indulgent behavior, and that's a perfectly stupid line of reasoning. I'm aware of that.
What does your doctor tell you about that line of reasoning?
Oh, they roll their eyes. And actually, I did have one doctor tell me, kind of privately, if you could get it down to 5 cigarettes a day, I would just say, go ahead. It can't hurt at that level. But alas, I don't have it down to 5 cigarettes a day. It's more like 15 cigarettes a day. And so even that doctor wouldn't be pleased with me. So nobody's pleased with me.
My guest is Nancy Mears, and her new memoir is called Waist High in the World, A Life Among the Non-Disabled. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Nancy Mears, and her new memoir is about living with MS. It's called Waist High in the World. Nancy, you say you're a person who really likes solitude, but on the other hand, there's an etiquette to taking care from others, which demands a considerable degree of the very sociability that you think you lack.
Mm-hmm.
I thought
yes.
That was really interesting. I think I understand what you mean there, but I'm going to ask you to elaborate on it.
Well, I love being alone.
Mm-hmm.
And aloneness requires considerable physical capacity, something I'm sure you've never thought about. But to manage without anybody else around means that you've got to be able, for instance, to open and close doors, to answer the telephone, you know, very basic things. And I'm looking at a time when I won't be able to manage even those things. And I certainly can't manage very much as it is. I can remain alone all day because before he leaves for school in the morning, George makes me some lunch and puts it in the refrigerator. I can't make my own lunch. I wouldn't starve. You know, you can always call Pizza Hut or something, but the truth is that I can't really provide for myself without a lot of assistance. And at the moment, we can arrange things in such a way that I am alone for several hours every day without feeling too endangered. I have recently gotten a cellular telephone, which makes me feel just ludicrously yuppie, but which makes a considerable sense if I want to do things like falling off the toilet. It makes sense to be able to call somebody to one's rescue.
So did you keep that in the wheelchair?
So, in fact, generally I wear it on a cord around my neck. At the moment, it's in the side pocket of the wheelchair. But yes, I'm never without my cellular telephone now. But I still have got to have help with all those personal things, like showering and dressing and what have you. And particularly if anything happened to George, and this doesn't mean necessarily his death, but simply if he were to get, suppose he broke his wrist, for instance, something very simple and basically healthy like that, we'd be in a terrible pickle. We'd have to hire somebody to come in. Mm-hmm. And I dread that. I just dread that. If I were by nature gregarious, I suppose I could look forward to somebody's arrival as a bright spot in the day or what have you. But the bright spot in my day is people's leaving. Ooh, it makes me sound like a terrible prune, doesn't it? Sour old puss. But it isn't that at all. When I'm with people on my own terms, I'm happy to be with people. I'm having a lovely time talking to you, and I wish we were in the same room. But, as I say, for several hours a day, I need that solitude. It's like replenishment of some sort. Mm-hmm. It's very tiring now for me to be sociable also. It is just physically tiring to talk, particularly in a crowded situation.
Do you often think about your life and your identity before you got MS?
I think about my life before I got MS a lot, although not necessarily as something without MS, just I think all of us think about our pasts a lot. As far as identity goes, I look back and think I was a very wretched creature as a girl and young woman. I think my depression had probably started by the time I was 12 or 13, and of course it was undiagnosed for years, and then not awfully well treated. And I was totally without a sense of humor. Just the somberest, saddest creature you could imagine. And I like myself ever so much better now. And I think part of the reason I like myself is that I have MS, you know? It's loosened me up. It's opened me up. And it's also made me funnier.
Wait, do you think it's made you more forgiving of yourself?
Yes, perhaps that's it, that I am more forgiving of myself. I was an incredible perfectionist. My teachers made me skip the third grade because I used to get so distraught over anything less than an A that they thought it would be good for me to be put in a situation where I would have to get something less than an A. Only that didn't turn out to work at all. I simply went into the fourth grade and insisted on getting A's there, even though I hadn't gone to the third grade. The most dreadful consequence of which is that I never learned my multiplication tables. And to this day, I don't want you to ask me what 9 times 4 is. So I and that perfectionism continued. I started developing migraines, which is a pretty common accompaniment to that attitude. And it went on, and then suddenly I entered a life where I couldn't possibly be perfect. I am unquestionably damaged. I still get very angry with myself for my shortcomings and failures, for being crippled. I get furious with myself for being crippled. But I can recognize that when it's going on and let it go and say, not only am I all right this way, but I think I'm all righter this way than I was the other way.
The Supreme Court is currently considering the legality of assisted suicide. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Like a lot of people with disabilities, I'm troubled by it, by the question of whether this sort of thing should be legal. I have great sympathy for people who want to end their lives, but I also know I've lived very closely with cancer. I've lost a lot of friends to cancer. So even in the case of terminal illness, there are options that well people don't necessarily see. And particularly now with people with disabilities, able-bodied people may look at us and say, our lives are unbearable, our lives are intolerable, we should be helped to end them. That's what Jack Kevorkian did with all those people, many of whom had MS, by the way, on the basis of a single meeting, saying, well, of course your life is just dreadful, and let's get it over with. If that becomes an attitude in a society like ours, particularly where our values are so economically based, we begin to think about someone's life in terms of how many resources they're sucking up. It becomes very easy to hold that life cheaper than some other life, some able-bodied person's life, let's say. And that attitude can really permeate the whole society, to the point where those who are able think that us disabled ought to get out of the way and stop sucking up the resources. Mm-hmm. And those of us who are disabled feel so horrendously guilty about existing that we're driven to suicide. So I think that throwing this into the legal arena is probably not a good idea. It should remain, as it has for many, many centuries, a very private matter between a person and her caregiver, her health provider, her spiritual counselor, but not decided in the public domain.
Nancy Mears, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I had a great time.
Nancy Mears' new memoir is called Waist High in the World.